We will call to order the 30th of July. Welcome to the new biennia iteration of Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. And with that, we will convene a work session on House Bill 2808 relating to offender registration.
Chair Weston, committee members, House Bill 2808 is referred to Ways and Means from the House Judiciary Committee on Criminal Law, where it took a unanimous vote. This bill, in its original form, would have required offenders to register for any major crime. The fiscal impact of that was substantial, and amendments to that bill have been drafted as co-chair's request. They are before you in the -7 amendments. The -7 amendments, in effect, narrow the scope of the requirements for sex offender registration, dovetailing with the requirements that were placed before you and passed out of this body in Senate Bill 740, which is sex offender registration. That particular bill, 740, had an emergency clause. It did not have any retroactive application. This particular bill does apply retroactively for those offenders that have been convicted post-1971. It is also funded through the same mechanism that was done in Senate Bill 740, which is a fee charged to offenders that are required to be registered as long as they're not under community supervision. The fiscal impact that is placed before you shows that this bill is also effective January 1, 2001. So that what that does is it reduces some of the startup costs and the general fund need in this biennium. Senate Bill 740 has a sunset on it. This bill does not. So some of what you see in the amendments before you in the -7 are conflict amendments as well. We've taken this opportunity to eliminate the conflicts with 740. The only other amendment that I'm aware of to this bill to pass it out of committee today and make it ready for full would be to add language to add an additional appropriation to the Department of State Police for $205,335, which is part of the general fund startup funding. And another comment I need to make relative to the fiscal, this is a relatively new scenario where we're trying to collect about a $70 fee from sex offenders. So the revenue is somewhat tentative. They made some assumptions about the collection rate, and that's why we know that the general fund startup costs are necessary.
Yes, Jim.
Sorry, yeah.
Mary, on the proposed amendments, the -7, page 2, is that person who are on after January 1st, 72, has been convicted. Are they covered under that existing statute now?
The, you're talking about
Senate Bill
740?
Or? No, I'm on 2808.
This is a new requirement. This is not, there's no, nothing in place at this time for anybody, back to this, back to this time.
Going back.
Could that be considered double jeopardy or, double certain time because those that were convicted earlier fulfilled the requirements of their offense and served the appropriate incarceration and parole and probation, and now they would have to register completely as new offenders?
As I understand it, we've looked at the cases, and it's my understanding that going back and requiring them to register is not considered double jeopardy. There's been litigation in other states on that point that they've established an expanded sex offender registration date. The question in the back of my mind is whether or not requiring them to pay a fee as part of the registration is appropriate, and I think that that's more problematic. To extract them as a residual of their prior offense without any sanction on them, that is just having to fill out the paperwork is one thing. I haven't looked at cases about the fee issue. I will say that in all the testimony we took on this bill, we had a lot of folks who would be very vigilant about that issue, and we heard no testimony raising a legal issue about the propriety of charging the fee for the registration. I'm talking about folks as diverse as the ACLU and the criminal defense lawyers. Policy issues are raised as to whether this is a good idea, but I don't recall any testimony raising a legal issue about that.
Okay.
If I may, on another comment, follow-up in response, I suggest that we double-check with legislative counsel as this is moving on towards full ways and means to see if they could to check to see. Normally, they send me a memo or raise that flag, too, if they see that issue and they've not raised that flag. So I think it's a very legitimate question, and we ought to double-check with them.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, the date in 72, what date was it in the 80s when we started registering sex offenders, and why was not the date tailored in with that registration complex been already established rather than going back to December 31st, 71?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, two answers. One is the date chosen here is pretty clearly based on the new criminal code that was developed in 1971 and went into effect January 172, so they had a comprehensive revision where you could better identify the categories of sex offenses, and apparently that's why that date was chosen, and apparently better records have been kept since that date to track offenders so you can have a better idea who is subject to this. As to what happened in 89, I was on judiciary back then, and that's when I believe this was first established, this law, and we were simply looking at a fiscal issue as to going back. And it was also an experiment, something that was new, so we were dealing with new offenders looking forward. As time is going on, now there's a question of bringing prior offenders into the system. And I would note, the reason this has been brought up is the unfortunate history that we've had where someone will have had, say, and there was this case from Representative Lewis's district, a fellow who last had an offense in 1983, but had the neighbors been aware that he was a convicted sex offender felon, they say they would have had more caution, and he's a fellow who enticed the little 12-year-old girl to come with him to fix her bike or whatever, and then raped and murdered her, and the reaction was, why didn't we know that this person was a convicted felon who was a sex offender? And the reaction in that community was they wanted to know about those people, too.
One last question I have. If a person was charged as a felony sex offender and they served their incarceration and parole and probation and appealed at a later date to the governor to have their record expunged or overridden. I don't know the definition. You know the legal terminology that the governor would use to release the person from any further involvement. This bill requires that they be licensed for or registered for the rest of their life. Does it take into consideration those persons?
Mr. Chairman, if the governor pardons somebody, their conviction has been eliminated, so they would not be subject to that requirement. And anybody can apply to the governor at any time for pardon. He has constitutional power. He can also give them a clemency, which is a reduction of sanctions or sentence. And I suppose they could apply to the governor for clemency after the registration requirement, saying, this is some incident to my conviction and I would like clemency. Just as you can get a fine reduced through clemency or get a sentence reduced, you could probably have the registration requirement reduced through clemency. There is a provision, I remember, in the statute for misdemeanor sex offenders after 3 years to apply to court to have the registration requirement taken off of them. And when we get to the final point as to a felony sex offender, I'm not well versed as to whether or not there is a provision for them to seek removal of the registration requirement. There are provisions in the law that allow you to apply for expungement of your criminal record, but I think it's usually about 10 years, and I think it excludes sex offenders.
I just didn't know I was asking a question. Thank you.
Good question. Fair question. we are blessed or cursed, as the case and situation may be, with two additional fine counselors on the committee. Do you have any words of wisdom you want to share on the governor's clemency and pardoning ability or expungement and how this would apply to this bill? Do you see any problems?
Well, the answer is a nail on the head.
Yeah, I think what was asked has been answered. The question, I guess, from what Senator Hannah was asking is that because of the length and making certain that I can't remember, I'm going to ask the chair from this year when we've had this, I just don't remember if we discussed if there's going to be any type of screening as to individuals that would be covered or make, you know, in the sense of, I actually had a bill that was on the floor yesterday trying to replicate where individuals who had served their time and had their license revoked after they had served their time and gotten out, it caused a lot of hardship. Now, this, of course, is one of the much more sensitive issue and area as to we're going to be picking up people that would be 12, 13 years earlier in time than what's currently under the statute. I just don't remember if we had any discussions about if anyone from the Sex Offenders Supervision Network came in and gave us any comment as to the propensity of those individuals being in the position for reoffending. Now, clearly, there are people that are doing it because of the case that brought this bill forward. So it's kind of that policy issue, I think, that the Senator is raising, and I just don't remember any of that being discussed.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I do remember a discussion with the Sex Offender Supervision Network to the effect that folks that they are supervising, they think that does have some impact on their conduct, the fact that they're registered and that somebody is watching you. There are others that it has no impact on their conduct, apparently. For some, there is an impact. And as far as going back and bringing folks in, I can't remember any testimony about the effectiveness of that one way or another. The testimony all had to do with the public's desire to know, that parents wanting to know that someone down the street had been convicted of a felony sex offense, even if it was back in 1979, that we did have testimony that the tendency to commit sex offenses against other people, criminal sex offenses of a felony level, can be attenuated with treatment, but not eliminated. And in some cases, treatment doesn't make any difference at all. And we did have testimony to the effect then that this is a group of offenders, unfortunately, that are least capable of rehabilitation and need to be, many of them need to be in some sort of a system of control, and that registration is a form of control where they then perhaps will control their own conduct. Their desire to offend may not be controlled. And I want to be careful about not saying this was across the board, because they've always made it clear some folks can be helped and pulled away from this. But in terms of comparison to other tendencies to commit crimes, such as theft or whatever else, it's much harder to find a clear rehabilitation with sex offenders. You are at best generally limiting the potential. You're not eliminating it.
Mr. Chairman, another reason I raised the issue was I would prefer not to have some court strike it down later and say, well, you went back in time and you exceeded your ability to limit
when that person is accountable. It's not that I want to be soft on these types of offenders. I want to make sure that whatever we do, that if it should ever be challenged, I have the same concern. A lot of times people don't show up in this building, but they say, I'll meet you in court later and challenge what you tried to do. And you have to ask the rhetorical response was, where were you when we discussed and debated this thing? So I only do that for the record, and I support what you're trying to do, but I want to make sure that we somehow don't get thrown out the window later and then people look at us and say, why didn't you draft it correctly to begin with?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I appreciate that. In fact, I would suggest that we ask our staff to touch base with legislative counsel before this comes up in front of the full Ways and Means Committee to confirm that, or to get some some read on the question of the fee for registering, I'm less concerned about the retroactive registration, because if someone does not want to have to register, I guess they can apply to the governor to have that taken out. But there has been a, I mean, tracking somebody through that system has been tested in the courts, and so far that part has stood out.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Patridge.
Chair, I'm comfortable if we ask LC that they move this to full. So at this point, after the further discussion, I'd move the dash 7 amendment to House Bill 2808 with the LFO recommendation.
I want to do two motions.
Okay.
So Representative Patridge has moved the dash 7 amendments to 2808. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, just one last question. I hate to be such a party pooper today.
The leadership in the Senate has indicated an unwillingness to pass legislation this session that postpones the enactment until the next biennium, and therefore includes a substantial roll-up cost. And I noticed here on the fiscal impact that it has $228,000 fiscal impact general funds this session, and then the fees that would be collected for the next biennium is almost $1 million, and the general fund goes up $261,000. Has anybody discussed those potential roll-up costs?
I can assure you that there have been
substantial discussions on those roll-up costs and a carefully calculated...
I just asked you for the record, Mr. Chairman. I would be derelict in my duty if I missed the question.
Chair Westman, Senator Hammond, appreciate your question. That was looked at extensively. The general fund startup costs are looked upon probably as being incurred primarily in the first two biennia and then going down substantially after that, and as it's ideally stand on its own with the fees.
Okay. There's a try to register all the existing offenders, and then as they continually, regrettably, continually come on, it will be a much lower cost. Did you have anything else?
In fact, that's my point, because you have a roll up, and then you have a roll down,
if everything's fine.
Yeah. Okay, we have a motion before us to incorporate the DAC 7 amendment to 2808. Any further discussion? Any dissension? Seeing none, so ordered. And I will accept a motion to move $205,335 general fund.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Into the bill. Any discussion on the fiscal appropriation? Any dissension? Seeing none, so ordered.
Okay.
We just amended the bill.
I move the bill to full ways and means of the
deal. Representative Mannix has moved House Bill 2808 as amended to the full committee with the DUPAC recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I am going to propose this at this point with the caveat that we already had that this is going to be reviewed by LC. I am going to ask to reserve my vote on the floor. My biggest concern is what Senator Hannon brought up at the very end, is the operative date being sometime in the future for what's going to potentially be a large roll-up cost if we aren't able to do the fees. And so until we get some word back from LC, I'm not sure what I want to know, but I want to get it out and keep the process moving forward.
I appreciate your courtesy vote. Representative Zabansky, I reserve the right to be a mere yes here today and an enthusiastic yes before. Any further discussion? Any dissension? Seeing none, House Bill 2808 has amended. It is moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. I would like to compliment Representative Lewis for 4 years of hard work getting this bill to this point, and hopefully we'll be able to pass it further. And I would encourage Tom to tell her that we got it out. It was a hard fight. Fairly. In fact, I'd encourage you to go tell her that it failed.
Oh no.
This could not be the day to tell
her. Yeah, this would be a bad day. Okay, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2808, and we will reopen the work session on House Bill 2808. On the floor, we will have Representative Lewis carry it. In full committee, do we have any volunteers? Representative Lewis on the Senate. Do we have any?
Full carrier. Okay.
Representative Senator Hannon. Okay, we will then close the work session on House Bill 2808 and open the work session on House Bill 3057 relating to identity theft.
Mr. Winston and committee members, I place before you copies of the -A14 amendments to this bill. This bill was brought before this committee on June 17th, wherein we discussed the fiscal impact. At that time, there were some -9 amendments before you. What these amendments do is eliminate the charge of identity theft for an officer when a person lies to an officer about their identity. And also holds into the receipt property statute the provisions of identity theft. It does not contain some other things that are subject to non-first amendments in a conference committee. My understanding from talking to counsel, those issues will be addressed once those issues are resolved by that conference committee. As amended, this bill has approximately a $94,000-$95,000 impact on the Department of Corrections, Community Corrections grant, the small prison debt impact, and indigent defense impact. The only amendments that I'm aware of to this bill that would be necessary to pass it out of committee is, again, there would be an appropriation added to it to cover the community corrections grant for $94,694.
Don't we need to amend the 814 then?
We can do both like we did the previous bill.
I move the A14 amendments with the addition of the appropriation of $94,694.
Is everyone familiar with the motion? What is the state of the motion? Representative Perdanski.
I'll go to go over the second part. I understand the identity theft part, but the condition part, like multiple conditions, what are we accomplishing with that?
Again, yeah, as with Secretary Manning, I want to speak to this as well. As with other repeat property offenders provisions, there is a there's an ability to get to 13-month minimum either through previous convictions of certain charges, and then if they have four previous or the other listed charges, they can also get to that minimum.
Thank you.
Consistent with the other provisions under the repeat property statute.
Thank you for your clarification.
Any further discussion or clarification? Any objections to the motion to amend House Bill 3057? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Manning.
I move House Bill 3057 to the full committee with a DCAC that we need.
Representative Mannix moves House Bill 3057 as amended to the full committee with a DCAC recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Patrick.
Chair, I would like to vote at this point. I just think that there's a lot of very good bills that came out of Representative Mannix's committee that may have a greater impact on public safety than this particular piece of legislation would based upon the cost, but I will move it forward at this point.
I appreciate your concern. I'd also hypothesize that there are a great many bills that came out of Representative Manning that will have a great less impact on public safety than I couldn't.
We're a holistic committee.
Yeah, I mean, it's a full spectrum. I mean, but I just is a holistic process.
But I would agree that these crimes are a substantial irritant and large health problem
growing,
for the public and growing, unfortunately, based upon the use of computers.
You see the check washing scan?
Yeah.
I didn't know you could do that.
I didn't show you how to do it.
He reads a lot.
Yeah.
For sure.
Representative Mannix has moved House Bill 3057 as amended to full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 3057 is as amended is moved to full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, just bring me that check you got today.
Yeah. We need interiors, Representative Beyer can carry it on the floor. Interiors in full.
Oh, cool.
Carol Senator Gordon carrying it on the Senate floor. And interiors in full. Representative Patrick. Okay. We will adjourn the work session on House Bill 3057 and open.
Chair Westland, committee members, we left off yesterday just having a public hearing on those two bills. I think the appropriate place to pick up from where we left off yesterday would be with completing the hearing, the public hearing on House Bill 2488. At which time I think we'd be in a better position to do a work session on both of those bills.
Okay, we will open the hearing, public hearing on House Bill 2488 relating to inmate work program.
Chair Winston, what I'd ask the department to come prepared to do today was to go over at least at a relatively high level the nature of the changes made in 2488 since it left the House Committee on Criminal Law, just so the committee could understand the nature of those changes. And if you had any questions you wanted to ask, you could share with those today before we go to work session.
I think we went over this pretty well. I'm fairly comfortable with it.
I don't know how other members of the committee feel. I know you have some particular questions. I don't know if we need to go into
Mr. Chairman, I stayed through the whole session yesterday, so my colleagues had to leave for various reasons, and my comfort level is such that I think both of these measures should be referred out with a due pass recommendation. I think that we had quite extensive testimony, a lot of questions were asked and answers given yesterday. Senator Gordley was here, I don't know my comfort level,
I did have an opportunity, Mr. Chair, to visit with Mr. DeHaan in my office on yesterday afternoon. However, you know, he is prepared to provide some information. I would like to hear again what that information is. I can't recall what we asked him to come back with, to tell you the truth. So what are we expecting?
I think we're expecting a fairly high level, very brief overview of what changes have been made, you know, to the bill in the amendments from the time it left Representative Maine's committee. So if you could do that very briefly, if you will indulge the senators. I also want to hear from Jeannie O'Rourke on a weaning program and how that may fit into the overall program. So, Ben, if you could come forward. Emphasis on brief.
Sure, is this a three-minute rule?
Did their budget get through the Senate today?
No.
It's coming up on Tuesday.
Well, it's scheduled actually for December 31st.
Let me remind you, your budget has not passed the Senate. Chair, I will be as brief as I can possibly be. Will there be any other questions?
Did we ask you for some information yesterday?
Did you identify yourself? You haven't got it down yet. This is my last chance to tell you. You haven't even identified yourself.
Mr. Chair, I can see from the sticker on here, and I understand you put that on there just for me. I will identify myself. I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. With me at the table today is Michael Tate. He's the Administrator of the Inmate Work Program. What I've been asked to do today is to, first of all, I was asked to go through the bill section by section, but I'm not going to do that. But I do have it in writing. So what we can do is hand it out, if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair, and the members can take a look at it, and if there are any questions, we can handle it that way. Also in writing, we have a summary of all the major changes in the bill. It's a one-pager, and we'll hand that out as well. And then I think what I'll do on the record, if it's okay with you, is I'll have Michael just very quickly talk about the three major areas that have been altered through the amendment process, and then open it up for questions.
Quickly.
Mr. Chair, I'm a member of the committee. My name is, for the record, is Michael Tate, Administrator of the Inmate Work Program for the Department of Corrections. And the areas, and to hand that around to you, the areas and the agencies that we've had some great dialogue with regarding changes to what was originally proposed by the Attorney General's Office, of course, Department of Administrative Services, and the Treasurer's Office. The AG's office, we had some discussion yesterday about the area that had great discussion, which required in-house counsel to be provided to the new entity, Oregon Correction Enterprises, and that does remain in the bill, but you heard from yesterday from AG that we and they both are open to dialogue about how that is best work. They recognize a very unique need, as we do, and we'll work together to make that work efficiently. The Department of Administrative Services raised some issues around risk management, and some changes were made there that better brought this entity into line with the intent. There were some questions about who accounts and how monies would be held for the entity, and some issues there were clarified to better meet DAS's direction, and an issue around the PEB, the Benefits Board, and again, some changes were made to meet with DAS's direction there. The Treasurer's Office had some issues initially around debt financing outside of DAS, and changes were made there to bring debt financing for this entity through and under DAS, which remains in the bill, should it be adopted with the outstanding amendments. I'll stop there.
Great.
Thanks, Chairman.
Senator Hannon.
The section 3 that you have written down has been on 2488, sets as a semi-independent state agency. Would the Oregon Corrections Enterprises funds both their accounts that they have receivable and budgets for expenditures, would that be included in the Department of Corrections budget, or would it be independent because it's a semi-independent state agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, it would be independent, and the bill specifies to report that also as an independent agency. They would work with DAS, as some of the other quasi-independent agencies do, to specify what level of reporting would be necessary. But it would be separate, and we would be, or they would be reporting back to the legislature, at least in the bill, on a yearly basis, and other reports as required.
The reports back, though, would not have anything to do with oversight of their budget.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I'm not quite sure what the language is in, I think it's 1127, that addresses the extent to which quasi-public agencies report under what situations and what detail. I think Bill McGee from DAS is more knowledgeable about that. I'm not sure exactly what that report would look like.
Okay. Maybe we can hear from Mr. McGee after a little bit on that subject. We'll get you up, give you your own dog and pony show, Bill, because I think that's an excellent question. Inmate work program area, do you guys have adequate financial accounting and comptrolling services? We're going off in a whole new direction here. I appreciate the flexibility. I appreciate the innovation in this. I think we're moving in absolutely the right direction. On the record, can you guys handle this? What have you done to prepare yourself to handle this? You got into trouble some time ago. I think the state police had to step in and possibly perform some services. So I guess that's two questions. One, what happened since, when did that happen, 95, 96? 95. What have you done to change things since 95 when you obviously didn't have the controls? And then what
have you done to ensure, you know, that this new innovative program would have adequate financial support?
Mr. Chair, I'll take a stab at it, then I'll let Michael address it. When I went to the department in 1995, there was a considerable amount of concern about the fiscal practices of our prison industries at that time. It was called Unigroup, you may remember. Basically, they operated as an independent entity. They had their own board, and they were pretty much, to be frank about it, estranged from the department. There wasn't a great deal of oversight. What we did, of course, other than change all of the leadership, we integrated them as a division, just like any of our other divisions in the Department of Corrections, subject to the same level of oversight. We spent a lot of time in the last few years preparing them to gain more independence. Their fiscal accounting is overseen now by the department, and I think that our fiscal folks will say that their records are good, their expenditures are very clear. We think they're in pretty good shape, and it doesn't mean through this bill that they're going to be out completely on their own, but certainly we're comfortable with the fiscal health of the operation, and I'm given the system of governance that we envision in this bill, I think they can handle it. I think we can.
Give me three specific reasons why. What have you done? I mean, this is a different, you know, this is a different duck than we've ever had before. What have you done in anticipation of the implementation
of this? I might take a stab at addressing that. Between 1995 and now, we have gradually taken on more direct financial accountability. That is, incorporating individuals, people who handle payables, receivables, accounting within inmate work programs, rather than the central functions at the dome building at the Department of Corrections. So over the course of these last 4 years, gradually, inmate work programs has become, in essence, a standalone entity producing those reports within the Department of Corrections for itself. That includes hiring people into specific roles to do that, and we have today a independent, other than system-wise, we have an independent accounting function within inmate work programs that is able to produce those reports and take care of accounts receivable, payable, and other matters.
So it's your firm belief, your assertion, that the existing controls you have in place, the existing accounting systems, are adequate and flexible enough to cover this new system?
Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Okay, that would be correct without the addition of additional people in the accounting arena. That infrastructure is in place.
Go ahead.
It's also important that HCR 82 is tied to 2488. 2488 does not go into effect unless HCR 82 passes. HCR 82 constitutionally makes it clear that the Director of Corrections is ultimately responsible for all these prison industry activities. So even though we may have a statutory arrangement here, constitutionally the Director of Corrections is the big kahuna or the chief or whatever, the man in charge or the woman in charge of prison industries, and there will be a control factor constitutionally.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Mr. DeHaan, what section or sections of the bill describe or define legislative oversight?
Senator Gordley, Section 8 makes reference to the report back to the governor and the legislative assembly, but there are some other issues that need to be worked out in administrative rule, particularly as the information is in here now, and some other DAS requirements that I think are necessary.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about those, and then I do have another question.
Senator Gordon,
sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
the record, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Chair, Senator Gorsuch, as a semi-independent agency, the legislature will not review and approve the budget for Oregon Corrections Enterprises. That is the model for all the semi-independent agencies that have been created over the past few years. They do an annual report, which is identified in Section 8, I believe, that will provide information. The Department of Administrative Services and Department of Corrections have agreed that we'll work together on administrative rules in regarding a number of different areas that we didn't feel needed to be dealt with statutorily. Those rules will involve how the budget is developed for OCE, similar to the Simple 1127, which is a semi-independent bill this plan, that will provide for the use of the same expenditure and revenue categories as used in all other agency budgets, that will provide for a process when and how the OCE will adopt its budget. So you will have the opportunity to review that budget, and of course, if you wanted to bring it in during the Ways and Means hearing or at another time, we'll have a considerable conversation about it. Of course, your choice.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I have another question.
Oh, excuse me.
Section 23, according to the summary sheet that you handed out, let's see, amends ORF section on public records exemption purposes to exclude certain documents from public records disclosure. And as I'm reading section 23 in the bill, I'm trying to reconcile the language in the bill to the statement in the summary that the purpose is to exclude certain documents from public records disclosure. Can you help me out there? I just want to be clear on what we are doing or not doing.
Sure, Senator Gordley, I'm sorry, the numbers don't correlate. The reference section in the summary is reference to the revised bill that you don't have in front of you, revised with the -10 amendment. So the section in the bill you have in front of you would be different, and let me see if I can find the appropriate section.
Okay, what I'm interested in is what it is we're excluding from public records disclosure, what certain documents are we talking about?
We have heard very clearly from the companies that engage with us as private partners that there are records that they provide to us to go through a discussion about whether they're an appropriate partner and the financial health of their company and other documents. That once they provide those documents to us, they become public record, and they're very uncomfortable with that and have expressed that very clearly to us. So this is intended to be able to clearly keep certain private company records out of public disclosure.
Can you give me an example of what is it? What kind of information would we not want to disclose?
For instance, Senator Gorley, privately held companies who do not necessarily have to disclose because they're not stock held, for instance, are very proprietary about their financial information. Whether that's good or bad, or if they're healthy or not healthy, it doesn't really matter. They're just very proprietary about it, and they want to keep that information as closely held. It's a trade secret to them, as are some of the processes that they may share with us to engage in making products.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, that's one of many areas where when the private sector interfaces with government, they're just not used to operating in that way. And it's one of the many difficulties trying to form private partnerships within the context of government. So it does allow us the flexibility that we can give our assurances to those companies.
Sure. I add to that. The main point is that if we're going to go into a partnership with a private company where they may be engaging some inmates, we want to make sure they're economically healthy. We're going to ask them to show us some of their confidential financial data so that the folks in corrections will say, okay, this is a healthy company. It's a good idea to go into business with them and have them employ inmates rather than do some fly-by-night thing and have it fail. But by their very nature, a lot of the companies say, you know, this is my tax return from last year. It's not public records. We don't want other people to see it. They want to be able to see it. And so this is a compromise to allow those private companies to show their records, but then know that they won't be put into the public record system.
Okay, well, just to follow up, the language, though, you don't have in front of us. Is that what you're saying?
It's in the A-10 amendment.
It's in the A-10
amendment. It isn't already in the bill, but the section would be numbered differently.
Okay.
Representative Gorley, section 29.
Okay. In the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gorley, it would be page 15 of the bill you have in front of you, line 10.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome. Senator Hannon.
Is this, refresh me from where we were yesterday, is this taking all prison industry and including it into this OBC now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, it would include our industries and private partnerships. It would exclude inmate labor, the inmate workers. And it also does not include all of the training programs, and it doesn't include all of the work that's done in support of the institution, which is about 60% of the inmate hours worked.
Okay. Now, refresh me, if we don't have legislative oversight on the budget, in the 25 years I've been here, we've always subsidized prison industry for general fund money. Is that a correct assessment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, there will be no general fund in here.
Well, I recognize that, but the point is, what action have you taken? The chair asked you three reasons why this is going to sell. You haven't been able to sell the boat for 25 years. What wind, gust of wind is now coming through the Capitol is going to carry out on your own and be able to defend for yourself.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I can't go back 25 years, but I can go back a couple of years. I can go back to 1995, and I think most of us would agree that during that time, there was very little accountability over at, what was the Unigroup operation. And I can tell you a couple of things that we've straightened out. First of all, they had no idea how much money they had and how much money they were spending. And in fact, it was very clear that they were spending money on staff that they didn't have. They were spending what we refer to as the DAF budget internally because they couldn't cover their payroll. They had very little regard for that. And although it sounds harsh, the people who were involved in managing that program are no longer with us. And we don't do business that way. The other thing that we've done, again, they were operating under the auspices of a private board, and frankly, the Department of Corrections had very little to say about their spending behavior, their strategies for making money, particularly about their advertising practices. At that time, they were selling prison blue jeans by putting them on in Playboy magazine, for example. Obviously, that would be distasteful to most people. They were marketing their goods based on a bad boy image, so we got rid of all of that marketing strategy, and we don't do that anymore. Before they became more independent and we started giving them their own business functions, we basically incorporated them into the part of the department, created auditing positions that went out and audited not only their planning but their expenditures, and so I can say that we established a very high level of accountability. At this point, because we have stronger relationships with our institutions and I think a very good working relationship with the folks over there, I think that we can trust them to move them out into a semi-independent status with the proviso that the management line of authority at the department have full control over what they do still. Dave Cook, myself, and Michael Pace are still responsible for that operation. Michael is still appointed by the director of the department, and the department is the equivalent of the chairman of the board, Dave Cook is, that is. And so I think that we've got a very strong line of control, and I think we have a greatly improved operation over there. I think our audit function would indicate that we're in pretty good shape.
How much money are you currently taking with you as you become semi-independent? That has been verified. You said that you now know where you're at, whereas previously you didn't know where you were at. And if you know where you're at, how much money are you taking with you?
Chair, Senator Hannon, the cash account today would be approximately $2 million.
And that's for all prison industry work?
Yes.
Including the blue jeans. Because one of the things for the other members, we've always subsidized prison industries with a healthy tune of several million dollars every biennium because it was not a profit-making situation. And my concern is, Sheriff, if we let go of legislative oversight, make it a semi-autonomous independent agency, then let me ask you this. What happens if we create this bill and the people vote for it? And then all of a sudden, 18 months down the road, you get into financial difficulty with prison industries. Where are you going to go? Can't sell your assets, so where are you going to go?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hann, because it's still technically part of the department, if they engage in business that doesn't make money and it's unsuccessful, the business goes away. We aren't going to be spending down general fund as they did in the past. So to the extent that they're operating businesses and they aren't profitable, that's it. They don't have any money to operate with. They can't spend the Department of Corrections money or they can't spend the general fund because they don't have any appropriation to do so.
Okay, my next question then is, you got a $2 million prison going in. That's what you just stated a few moments ago. It wouldn't take really one bad decision to wipe out that $2 million. And then what happens to the Department of Corrections jobs for inmates?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, the $2 million cash, I think if we back up a second, and Michael will probably want to weigh in on this. Inmate work programs don't demonstrate a profit in the traditional sense. The money that they make is plowed back into new businesses, machinery for the inmates to use, and so forth. So when you're thinking $2 million, that's a cash balance, and I wouldn't want you to think that that's $2 million worth of profit that they're going to walk away with. The industries themselves represent about, this balance changes, about 10 or 11% of the overall compliance rate for the department. They represent a relatively small proportion of our compliance efforts, but they also represent probably the largest area of potential growth because institutional support is pretty well maxed out. You can only have so many people pushing brooms and so forth. So our theory here is, and I think it's a sound one, is that to put the rest of these inmates to work, you have to have healthy, self-sustaining businesses to grow naturally and create more jobs rather than divide up rooms or cells and have people sweep smaller and smaller areas and give more people jobs to share. So what we're doing here is growing successful businesses, and we're trying to draw a bright line between general fund operational money for the prisons and what is a very small part of our operation, the more entrepreneurial business side. So that's kind of a long-winded way to say that this is a small part of our operation, but it has huge potential if we can cut it loose and let it perform the way that we think it can.
So, Mr. Chairman, one last question. In the next 3 years, after my term, you will not be back to the board or the legislature asking for general fund appropriations.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hyman, I will not come back to you and ask the general fund to bail out a bad business deal that they've gotten themselves into.
Let me follow up on that a little bit, because I didn't think that's an excellent line of questioning. You have the ability to loan money. You do not have the...
Borrow money,
Excuse me, borrow money.
loan or borrow to the startup entrepreneurial enterprise. And they have the ability, I mean, these entrepreneurial enterprises have the ability to borrow money. Yes?
Mr. Chair, with DAS's approval, yes.
Mr. Chair, Bill McGee, they have the authority to come to the legislature to request certificates of participation or other financing methods in the same way every other state agency does. They do not have any independent authority to go to a bank and ask for a loan. So they would have, you could ask for COPs anywhere anybody else could from you, but they don't have any independent authority to go borrow money on their own.
But are you going to be doing business with other independent businesses?
Mr. Chair, yes, we will.
And they have the ability to go out and borrow money.
That's correct.
To help finance the prison enterprise portion of their business.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And so if that business fails, my concern is, what is the state of Oregon's obligation if that debt remains, the business has failed, they declare bankruptcy?
Mr. Chair, the state of Oregon does not have any liability in such case through contractual agreements with our partners, our current partners, related contracts and AG, if they're here, may want to weigh in on this, but the contract structure at the state does not carry liability.
Mr. Chair, one more issue related to that is in our earlier conception of what this organization should look like, the Health Sciences University model, that was one of the downsides to that model. That is, that we could jeopardize the state in those kinds of arrangements. And I believe now in the lawyers that have to weigh in on this, I believe that we've eliminated that possibility.
Okay. Any questions? Further questions for Mr. DeHaan or Mr. Tate? Why don't you hang out just a little bit? While you're still up there, let me ask Bill. In an overview, I think there were a good many of these, but what were the primary concerns for DAS when the bill was put out of committee in its A and goes to conversion, and have those concerns been addressed by the amendments before you?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, let me give you that. The concerns that we had that we felt were needed to be dealt with statutorily are listed in Ben's handout here regarding insurance, the account holder, and that issue. Those have been resolved all to our satisfaction. As I said earlier, we have some other issues we want to work with them through the administrative rule process, how the budget's developed, using general accounting rules, and a number of smaller things that don't need to be in the bill. So we have all our issues resolved.
Okay. Any other questions for?
I think it would be good for them to understand how you're going to separate inmate work programs from work crews inside and outside from inmate work programs, because there's a clear break being made here, and I don't think that they've really heard about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the issue that Larry raises is a recent policy choice that we made to separate the functioning of the crews, the outside work crews that rehab schools or work in the community, you've seen them around town. Those are clearly within the purview of the institutions, and if they make money at it, that's fine, but it's not going to involve the inmate work programs. The reason for that is that you can't really clearly consider labor leasing as a separate business. It's too closely related to the overall purpose of the institutions. So what we've done is that we've made inmate work the responsibility of all of the superintendents. They have all their security staff that they have to use, and the proviso is that they get all these staff, they have to use them for security, and that includes inmate work. And labor leasing, as we call it, is part of that. So it's a very clear separation, and the responsibility will not be a part of OCE in the way that we conceptualize it.
Well, just to follow up then, for Senator Hannum's question was, would the general fund subsidize this in any way? If any of those work supervisor positions are general funded, will they be used to support or supervise work that's being done by OCE?
know that if there's a general fund involved in the supervision of the crews, that's within the operational budget of the institutions. And if they, for example, want to maintain the golf course in Ontario and they aren't being reimbursed through other funds through revenue of $400 a day and they use some of their existing staff, then they're going to have to make it up in CRCI and Columbia River in Portland. They have to balance the budget and they only have so many general fund dollars, so it actually forces them to consider work in the community as an investment, and they have to figure out how to pay for it within the general fund or other fund categories.
So what I heard you say is if OCE needs work crew supervision, that they would probably in effect be contracting back almost with the institutions to provide other funded positions to provide that supervision. Is that
okay? That's certainly one scenario.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. The key point here is that private sector partnership activities are going to be kept physically separate in the sense that if you have work crews, you're going to know whether they're there for that sector activity, or if you have someone working in a factory or in a training program with a private employer or whatever, they're also fiscally separate. So you can identify those separate outside private sector partnership activities and make it clear that they are profitable, or if they're losing money, you see it. And you're not in the back room subsidizing it through your prison budget, your general fund.
That's exactly correct. They're separate functions, and what we don't want to do is get into the business of using general fund to subsidize private businesses.
If I can follow up then. So if you go out and you're helping maintain the Ontario Golf Course, which I assume is a private sector thing, you're privately showing enough money coming in to pay for that activity or make a profit at that activity. On the other hand, if you have a work crew that went out to help fix up City Hall in Ontario, which is a government, local community, charitable or whatever community benefit, that's okay. That's part of prison operations. That's not your profit sector operation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Manis, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions for Bass or DLC? No, we want to hear from Dean
Arana. Oh, okay. Then we'll be ready for several motions.
Sure, I'm glad we spent those 3 minutes.
You know, it appeared to me that the individual, we won't mention any names, that was most comfortable had some of the most penetrating questions, I thought.
It just raised new flags upon your absence yesterday, Your Honor. In your absence, I thought I had a series of answers given to me, and new information came to light today that I had serious gastric distress over, and I wanted to review that.
Oh. It appeared to me all day you've had gastric distress.
Only in this committee, Mr.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jean Arana with the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. One of my positions over there is to coordinate the efforts of the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger, which is a policy-making board or policy-level board making recommendations to the governor on issues of hunger in the state of Oregon. Membership on that council consists of agency directors and administrators from divisions who touch on hunger issues, to include housing and community services through our partnership with the Oregon Food Bank, DHR, Adult and Family Services, Department of Education with their nutritional programs for children, and recently, in this past year, the governor has added the Department of Corrections, primarily for two reasons. One, there is already a relationship between corrections and the Oregon Food Bank up in Portland. The use of inmate labor from the Columbia River Correctional Facility to sort goods over at the Oregon Food Bank has been very successful. The second reason is a concept that was broached to the council, and the council made a decision in January to recommend a contract to do a very preliminary study of a concept that expands the partnership between corrections and the food bank. That concept is a food salvage recovery operation and or a food processing operation utilizing inmate labor. The proceeds or the result of that food and increased capacity would benefit the food bank. We did recommend that contract with Professor Jim Cornelius, who is an agricultural economist from Oregon State University. He did do a very cursory study that he completed in March, and out of that came the recommendation that this is a concept that is well worth doing a full focus feasibility study to determine if this is something that would work both economically and would accomplish what it set out to do, and that is to provide more food to the food bank and provide some skill and job training to the inmates. We have not done that study. The recommended cost of that is about $25,000 to do that focus study, and those funds have not been identified as of yet. Also, since that preliminary study, some additional things have come to light. One of those is Inside Oregon Enterprises has identified 20,000 square foot building located at the prison farm in Salem. It's the slaughterhouse operation that has recently closed its operations, and that building is empty and possibly available as a site for one or the other of these proposals. Some other things that have come to light since then that were not a part of the preliminary study is the interest on the part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture Farm Service Agency, who have a very vital link with the large farmers in our state, and the Farm Service Agency has already approached the farmers and said, would there be an interest in donating the product to a food processing operation? And the answer was a resounding yes. We can give you as much produce as you need to keep that operation going. So I bring this to present a very unique concept that is in the very preliminary stages. I guess to see if there is any interest.
Great. I mean, I've been intrigued with this for quite a while. How many other states are operating some type of similar, food greening program, and have they been successful, I guess, is the key part of that question.
Mr. Chair, offhand, I know of at least three states that have done some kind of food-connected partnership between the food banks in their states and the Department of Corrections. Probably the first state that comes to mind is the state of Arizona. Arizona is really the national leader on this. They also have a coordinating council similar to the one we have in Oregon. Their prison utilizes fields that surround the prison outside of Phoenix. And inmates actually go out into the fields, glean the harvest, transport it, actually load the trucks that are transported to the food banks. The food that they glean not only goes to food banks, it also goes back into the prison system and reduces their cost of feeding their inmates. And they are very successful with that program and always looking for ways to expand that relationship. Of course, in Arizona, they also produce enough food that it spills over and helps feed other states. I'm not sure if that's something we could see in Oregon, although there could be a national connection with Second Harvest, which is the national network that the food bank connects with. And they are very interested in a proposal like this in Oregon. Another state that utilizes the connection between corrections and the food bank is California. One of their programs that comes to mind is they have a real problem with transportation. Parts of California are very productive, but other parts don't really produce a lot of food, so how do they get the food to other parts of the state? They have developed a truck driving school. They utilize the Teamsters were involved in setting that up, Department of Education, the food banks, and then Department of Corrections. Inmates who are preparing for release can go into the training and learn a very valuable job skill. And then when they come out of that, they're required to drive the truck for the food bank for 6 months to repay and to learn to give back to the community. Washington State is another one that has a connection, not with the food banks as of yet, although we have visited their facility, and because there's discussion in Oregon, they are also interested in making a connection. They have a food sorting and packaging operation within the prison walls in Monroe, Washington, a private industry that has located in 70,000 square foot a building and employs the inmates, trains them, employs them, and pays them prevailing wage jobs, prevailing wages. And out of those wages, the prison system then takes room and board, any victim restitution, and so on. They are, that's a very successful program up there.
Okay.
The money that would be necessary to start such a program, was the money included in the Housing Community Services for the Food Bank to begin such a joint venture?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, no. The study had not been completed, and again, it was just a preliminary study to see if it would be worth going forward and pursuing the project and the partnership.
If the project were to be pursued, do you have an estimate of what the potential startup cost might be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, that project is a part of Professor Cornelius's study. However, there are some different factors involved. For example, there's a Council of Food Industry presidents who are very much involved in this concept, and there is talk of donation of all of the equipment to run a food processing line, which would significantly reduce the cost. Obviously, the building on the prison farm would reduce the cost even further because there wouldn't be the necessity for a building.
Would this food be processed primarily for food bank, or would it include fractions in the distribution of the food too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, I think that is a question that would be better answered in a feasibility study that has been discussed. I think the primary purpose would be, initially, at any rate, to provide more food into the food bank.
The reason I ask that question is, sir, remember, so we used to have our own pork farm, we used to have our own dairy farm, and we used to have a lot of row crop farms out at the prison farms to feed inmates and institutions, and then all of a sudden, there's always a change group that comes by and says, now we got to get rid of this stuff. So they didn't get rid of the slaughterhouse until one of the guards had his friend backing up with a big semi-coal trailer to the slaughterhouse and loading all these halves of beef on there and hauling it off the prison farm. That's when they made the decision to close down. I would really have to see a report that clearly delineated for me, to my satisfaction, before I'd ever be willing to support the state getting back in the food processing business, especially as it relates to corrections. There is so much room for abuse if it's not monitored very closely, and that's my concern that I have, is that I support the food bank and would certainly do anything to lend support and help to the food bank to gain additional foods and having inmate labor do the processing for the food bank, but I would prefer, my wildest concern is not to have the state corrections department back in the food business. They were there, they done that, and it didn't work. And I don't care to put them back in business.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hammond.
pretty good trick when you can pack a semi up to a hog farm and run off the slabs of beef.
Slaughterhouse, I said. Slaughterhouse, that's a hog farm.
As always, you're on top. Slaughterhouse.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, that is exactly the concern expressed by the Council of Food Industry President. They are very interested in the concept, but would like to be involved in any policy making and in determining how that would operate, would want to see the equipment owned and operated by the food bank as opposed to the Department of Corrections. They are concerned about competition and want to make sure that it stays within a market that is not one of their direct competitors. So that concern is definitely there.
Yeah. How do you guys handle your large bulk donations now? I mean, assuming you get in here enough to have a routinized method of doing that.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that currently the food bank sends its large bulk food to be processed to Spokane, Washington. The food bank there in Spokane does it for about $50,000 a year for the Oregon Food Bank, and certainly that would be money that could be retained in the food bank and be used in direct service. That $50,000 does not include the cost of transporting the goods to Spokane, nor does it include the storage costs for the food.
One other last question. If this were to come about,
would this have any impact on the greening statutes that we have already enacted, allowing the low income and the poor what glean in the field? Would this endanger or impact that gleaning process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hannon, it's my understanding that with USDA, who now has been given the responsibility of overall gleaning coordinators in the state, that the largest amount of the produce coming in would be shipments that go to a cannery and the cannery rejects them for whatever reason, that they're not quite up to the standards of that particular, but they're still a very good shipment of food, that then that can be routed into the food bank system, that it would not in any way impact those groups that are now out in the field. We have worked with Sharon Thornberry, who is the food bank gleaning coordinator, and she is very excited about this opportunity. And there certainly would be nothing to prevent gleaners. In fact, in Arizona, some of the bigger corporations get out in the fields on a regular basis and glean for the food banks around the prison. So.
Okay.
Any other questions for Ms. Serrano? Anything else you want to say?
Well, only to say that the department is not making a recommendation one way or the other on this, because it is not a part of our budget. We bring it to you for informational purposes as an example of the kinds of cooperative efforts that can happen between agencies, and also to show that there are some opportunities for inmates to get out and do some really good work in the communities that not only makes the community feel better, but also makes the inmates feel better.
Mr. Chairman, we sent out the Housing and Community Services budget, and there's a $1 placeholder in there for the food bank, and I would certainly encourage Ms. Rana to consider coming back under that $1 placeholder to be more,
if and when you're able to devise the concept of a plan with corrections. Maybe come back under that provision, because we've already sent forth that proposal. Here's an opportunity to report to the e-board on what you're doing and the next step that you're trying to venture into. And
I would certainly be willing to entertain a report like that during the interview.
Well, hey, we need to get funded for the report. Maybe we
can start there. So we take any questions?
It's a privilege to serve and a financial burden. One thing I want to stress, and I know the committee heard this, the last thing Mr. Rana was saying was let's get prison industries back into food production business again. I did not hear that as a primary issue of discussion in her remarks.
Correct me if I'm wrong. What I heard you saying is let's see where we can work out some partnerships for food greening, buster benefit, inmates, inmate labor, and the food bank as well, which is part of where I hear this whole revision of the inmate work program going. So I think it's a very timely presentation, and I appreciate your patience for 2 days being here and you being able to make the presentation.
And I would never, ever presume to say that you were wrong on the record.
On the record.
On the record. Let's hear from Dave. We got the big boss here. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, we got you now. Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. Is that in reference to what do I think about 2488 and HR82, or what do I think about Mr. Rana's presentation?
What do you think about Mr. Rana's presentation?
Well, I serve on the board that Mr. Rana described. I come late for that because the governor just added DOC to it. I think there are a tremendous number of opportunities for us to work cooperatively with the council and with the greening organizations and others. I do think that the study needs to be done to determine whether or not the DOC is, can efficiently do what it needs to do, if inmate work is gonna be beneficial, if we can set up a food processing line that is in some way going to serve the operation of providing food through the food banks and the other resources. But I've attended a number of those meetings. I think there's opportunity there. I think that occasionally people are surprised by what the DOC is in fact capable of doing. I don't know anything about inmates or staff backing up to slaughterhouses, but we shut the slaughterhouse down most recently because it is not profitable. We can buy in the spot market for a good deal less than we can produce our own beef. That may have been a piece of ancient history relative to correctional officers, but
within the last 15 years.
Okay, well, I think that there are.
And I mentioned all three.
Well, I didn't want to clarify it that way, but I think there have been good examples of inappropriate behavior, and I think the DOC has also made big strides towards professionalism. And we did recently shut the slaughterhouse down within the last several years, but that was an issue of economics more than anything else. I think it's a great opportunity. Gene and others on that group are fired up about this, as are we, and if we can find a way to fund the study, there are, I think, people awaiting the opportunity to donate their equipment, and we have the building, and we certainly have the inmates.
Great. Ready for motion? Is that important?
Yeah, we got to get Representative Manning. I knew this was going to happen. Are you going to rule? Yeah, all right. He's in rule. Yeah. We need a form to make a motion?
Yeah. Yeah, make a motion around the corner.
How far is Rules away?
Well, Rules isn't that far away, but
he?
Yeah.
Or he's going to work.
Okay. We'll be in recess.
I didn't even control this man. This is going to pass on the mind. Fuck the story.
We will reconvene the work session on So actually, we just reset the public hearing. We will adjourn the public hearing, and we will convene the work session on HJR 82.
Mr. Chairman?
Hold on. We've got a little...
So we have an amendment here.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the HJR 82-B4 dated 6/21/99. This is an amendment to the bill that sets forth that the laws would become 99 and rolled upon passage of 2254 if the voters approve at the ballot. And it just ties the two together. And I would urge its passage.
I support the amendment. Basically, that's going to allow HJR 82 to be on the election ballot this November. And if there isn't an election ballot this November, then we'll be on the next primary ballot if there isn't an election.
Yeah. I understand. Any discussion of the motion? Any objections to the motion?
So ordered. Mr. Chairman, do we need to move the legislative fiscal recommendation?
The LFO's recommendation is that there is no fiscal impact.
If it goes on the ballot with those other issues.
Right. The fiscal impact in the direction that would be addressed through the House Bill 2254 or by subsequent appearance by the Secretary of State.
Mr. Chairman, I would then move House Resolution 82 as amended to the full Ways Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none? So ordered. We need carriers. Would you carry it on the floor?
Yes,
and I'm going to fight over who carries it on the Senate side.
We don't fight, we cooperate. We have to do it.
I like that. And on the House side, Representative Manning,
you do it. Could I make a suggestion? If I carry this in the full Ways Means Committee, how about if Senator Gordley carries the House bill and we can work together as a tandem?
Sure.
How would that be? Mm-hmm. Would you accept that?
Absolutely.
See, I got a sweetheart for a neighbor.
Then you'll carry on the Senate floor as well.
Let the record.
So do I.
Let the record show that Senator Hannon and Senator Gordley are sweethearts.
Let the record show that. He's speaking for himself. Yeah, but we have the Northern American guys over here. I don't know what you call those guys.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was alluding to. But
they're in trouble.
So Senator Hannon will carry HJR 82 to the full and on the Senate floor. Okay, we're in a work session on House Bill 2488. Let me have Larry set these up a little bit. He's more involved, I think.
Well, it's a little more involved. We did entertain some conceptual amendments yesterday, and Representative Nance was aware of that. The two things will be in what would be a dash 11 amendment that Secretary of State mentioned. They were deleting some language that would deal with archived records in one case, and I believe in the other case had to do with 192.105 statute. So those references, as well as language including the requirement that OCE pay the cost of audits. So if that, the dash 10s with those two amendments.
Thanks, Chairman. Just one brief question. So yesterday we had the dash 8-10 amendment. And then there was a request from the Secretary of State for the language on the auditing payment of the cost. What was the other amendment? Was that it?
There was that audit cost, as well as deleting some language that related to archive record keeping requirements. And the freshman amendment at 192.05. I don't remember what that was in reference.
It was a specific statute that had to do with public records.
That was also archived as well.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I would move the House amendment, or the amendment to the House Bill 2488, identified as A-10, and the Secretary of State's proposed amendment, identified by the date June 30, 1999, to House Bill 2488.
Any discussion? That's a comprehensive amendment. Any attention? No votes, seeing none, so ordered.
Move it to the floor as amended.
Senator Hannon has moved House Bill 2488 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, sir. I'm just a little bit nervous about the way the issue of legislative oversight is framed, or at least the language in the bill, the annual report to the legislature and to the governor. But I have great confidence in Mr. Cook and Mr. DeHaan, great confidence in their leadership, which is to say that, you know, if issues, problems do crop up along the way, I know that we'll hear about them and that we'll have the opportunity to intervene or comment or do whatever is appropriate. So with that said, I'll be voting aye.
I appreciate your comments and your confidence, because I do share that confidence, and I feel this gives the department a magnificent opportunity. I think we've got a window here where we can launch a new and innovative program that I think they will be able to manage very well. So I appreciate your reservations and your concern, and the expected confidence that that concern will be enough.
Any other discussions? Any objections to the motion?
Seeing none, House Bill 2488 as amended is moved to the full committee with a due pass.
Recommendations are ordered. We have Senator Bordley is chairing on the Senate side. Mr. Manish, would you chair chairing on the House side?
Sure.
And I'll chair the full.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank the committee members for their patience and indulging me today, being able to come back and get in the saddle on this thing. Thank all the attendees for their patience. And be willing to indulge me in our leadership meeting yesterday. Any other business coming before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you, sir.